Domino, Domino, on the spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, Domino, on the spot a few blacks behind you.
Hello, everyone. I am your host, Robert Stevens, and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organization. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unappreciated, and in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their job and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience. However, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. I want you to know that you are not alone. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness at work, and potential loneliness. If you identify with majority culture, listen to the podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them or runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation or even calls them intimidating. Lean in, listen, and learn. That's what we're asking of you. All right, welcome back. We have our esteemed guest, Michael Brock, with us today. I'm super excited to have Michael Brock with us. Now, Michael is an electrical engineer in the aerospace and aviation industry. He's a proud member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. Shout out to the bros. He's a husband, he's a father, and he's a proud HBCU graduate of Tuskegee. And we want to shout out Michael Brock. Michael, welcome, welcome, welcome. Happy to have you here tonight.
Thank you, Robert, for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's get this bad boy. Let's get this show on the road. Tell us about yourself. Who is Michael Brock?
I am from Durham, North Carolina, born and raised in the Bull City. I am an electrical engineer.
Hold on. Shout out to the Bull City. Shout out to the Bull City. We can't let that go by. I'm an honorary member of the Bull City. They've accepted me. So shout out to the Bull City.
Yes, indeed. As you stated, I'm an electrical engineer. My background has been in the aerospace and aviation industry. I've been fortunate to work on many different projects, ranging from docking adapter on the International Space Station to designing and managing the designs of several Wi-Fi systems on commercial jets, and also doing a lot of system modifications on private jets. I'm fortunate to come from a family who values education and not necessarily just formally, but always immersing yourself in your interests. I'm fortunate to have parents who have always pushed me towards figuring things out on my own. So I'm a very inquisitive person, and I love to pursue the different ideas and thoughts that I have.
That is interesting. We have an inquisitive person. We have someone who's worked on, you know, Wi-Fi on jets. And I want to get into the heart of this. Like, when did you know you wanted to be an engineer? And like, you know, this podcast talks about black people being one of the few or the only people there.
Did you have someone, maybe a Black engineer or someone in STEM that motivated you or pushed you in this direction?
Well, I had an older cousin, and I say older, when I was, I guess, in my adolescent years, between like 8 and 12, who went to A&T and was an electrical engineer also. And when he got out of college, he worked for several different companies in different parts of the United States. And he always drove a Mercedes. So I always thought that was interesting. I don't think that necessarily pushed me towards engineering. I think that my inquisitiveness in car modification is kind of what pushed me towards engineering. When I was in high school, my father was a manager at Best Buy. And sometimes I would go to work with him, I'd say middle school, really, and just sit in the car shop. This is when the people who got their audio systems done would still go to Best Buy, drop their car off, and pick it up in an hour.
Oh, and they would install the CD players and stuff and all of that in there.
Yes, and they installed all that. So I used to sit back and watch what, you know, the employees were doing. And eventually I started doing that myself for some of my friends and just kind of cutting their costs as a side hustle. I also, and this may be unique, maybe it's not, but, you know, we had the internet and I looked up the top paying jobs without having to go to grad school. And I think like 7 or 8 of the top 10 were all engineering. And, you know, that compounded with being able to take some engineering classes at Hillside. It really pushed me to pursue an electrical engineering degree at this
point. My man said Hillside. Just a quick shout out to Hope County High School. We play Hillside Friday. We about to get this dub. Got a ride for Rafe the 9-1-9-1. No, the 9-dime. Just want to be clear. But no, so what I'm hearing you say you had an older cousin. You went to work with your pops and saw people installing like CDs and all the work inside of vehicles and your curiosity, right? Like you talked about this curiosity, it peaked. And so like, and then you cared about the bread. Money is important. So you saw all the top paying things. No, that's very interesting because we always say that, you know, you have to see it and exposure is so important. To see it, to understand it and to think that it's possible. So I think the value and the experience seeing all that is super important. But I want to talk about this because, you know, by all accounts, you know, you are an anomaly. You know, I did my little research. I did my Googles and I found out we got 2 million engineers in the U.S. And out of those 2 million engineers, only 4.5% are Black. Take us on a journey, right, through your professional career and like really explain, because a lot of people may not understand like what an engineer does. Succinctly, of course, and tell us, how did you get there?
So fortunately, Tuskegee University has a very reputable engineering program, especially their mechanical, chemical, electrical, and aerospace departments. I believe Tuskegee is still the only university with an aerospace engineering major. So one thing Tuskegee does really well is their career fairs. So every year, and I think at one point it was twice a year, we'd have these big career fairs and, you know, everybody would walk around with their resumes and meet different people. But I think what was unique was that there were so many engineering companies there. And for a while, if not, you know, still now, major corporations, when looking for diversity, go to the HBCUs. So I was fortunate to get an internship or a co-op with Gulfstream in Savannah, Georgia. And that really exposed me to the practice of engineering as opposed to the theory that I was learning in class. I guess to answer your question about what engineering is, it's really taking an idea and putting it into action. And, you know, that there are many different things that are involved within that realm of idea to action or idea to finished product. And I've been fortunate to work in, you know, several different aspects of the entire process of idea to product. At Gulfstream, I did a three round co-op rotation. So from 2007 till 2009, every other semester, I would go to Savannah. And that allowed me to grow, gain confidence, really, in what I was learning on the job and applying some of the things that I was learning in class. So that's really what got me into my professional career. And from there, I was able to look at other opportunities in different places and really kind of leverage what I thought my value was based on my.
Because we think about it. So you started at Gulfstream. And for those of us who don't know, I am them. I do not know. Gulfstream is the private jet company, right? Like they are the jets, right? So you started in the aviation sector, Gulfstream. And then after Gulfstream, you transitioned. Did you transition to the big, big airlines then?
No. So one thing that I learned at Gulfstream, my role after graduation was an electrical harness designer. Basically, you know, if you were to look at an airplane now, say you go onto an airplane and you were to take all the panels, strip all the panels down to like the bare fixtures, you would see wires running all throughout the aircraft. I would basically strategically position where the wires went, sometimes source different parts, and also have involvement in where certain LRUs, or I guess a layman word for that is like a computer that helps with either navigation or entertainment or what have you. But I gained a lot of skills there, and I realized that within my department, there were a lot of contractors. And at Gulfstream, at least the culture as it was then, for about 8 out of the 12 months in a calendar year, my department specifically was working at least 60 hours a week. Now, as a contractor, you're getting paid almost twice as much, if not more than twice, than what a new hire would be paid.
Is the pay discrepancy, is that, it's like that?
As a contractor, yeah, just because, I mean, there are trade-offs to it, right? You're not getting health insurance, yeah, no benefits, no paid time off. But, I mean, if you're not concerned with that, you know, that's money in your pocket. Yeah, you can eat. So learning that and you know, building those relationships with a lot of my teammates, I was able to secure a contract role with Sikorsky, who builds helicopters. They're now part of UTC, I think, which was bought by merged with Raytheon and became Raytheon Technologies. But I was able to do some design work on some Black Hawk helicopters that were basically upgrading and outfitting used Black Hawks for other countries and their military, basically the strategic alliances.
You've been able to travel all over the country with these jobs, right? Because I know, if I remember correctly, you spent time in Atlanta. I know you're in New Orleans now. You've been all over.
Yeah, so I've been very fortunate, very blessed. As far as the United States, I've been able to live in New York, Houston, when I was with Boeing working on the NASA project. From there, I went to Philadelphia, where I worked for Dassault Aircraft Services, which is actually in Delaware, but it's basically a private jet corporation. I was able to live in Chicago, working for Gogo, which is now Intelsat.
Shout out to Cordarius, my boy in Chicago. Shout out Cord. Okay.
And I got to meet Cord, man. Good dude. Real good dude. Always sharp.
Yeah, he linked me. He told me he met you in Chicago. Yeah, he told me that.
Yeah. I think we met at a Wale concert. Or it was like a Wale, not even a concert. It was like a what's the name of that? the alcohol brand that used to rival Hennessy. I forget the name of it. But I met him at one of their special events. But it was in Chicago that I was actually able to travel all over the world. And that really, that was very exciting, being able to actually do work on a project and get to visit different countries. I was able to go to Germany, Portugal, France, and then, you know, various cities within the U.S., you know, doing my job.
I'm so glad you talked about that, because, you know, for only 4.5% of engineers are Black. I did the math. I used to be a math teacher. I did the math. And that's like, out of that 2 million, that's about 225 Black engineers. And I want to hear from you personally, you know, like, how has your racial identity impacted your professional career? Do you think it's stymied opportunities, or do you think it's helped you grow or buoy them? Like, how has being a Black man, a Black engineer who is a man, impacted you in your career?
I believe that I've always had to be a little bit more thorough than a lot of my colleagues. Nowadays, you can't really prove if, you know, something is racially motivated or not. But I mean, I think us as Black people within, you know, the professional industry, sometimes we all have that thought, is this person either trying to scapegoat me or draw attention to me because of that, or, you know, are they just having a bad day, or, you know? So I think one thing in navigating the workplace in engineering is just making sure that, you know, I thoroughly investigate whatever my tasks are and make sure that, you know, I double check and triple check things so that I don't give anybody an opportunity to criticize my work.
So you feel like you have to work twice as hard. So there's this saying, right? Oh, you have to work twice as hard, right? Four times as hard to be half as good. You feel that. Do you feel that on your shoulders every day? Do you work with other people of color, Black people?
I do work with other Black people. And to answer your question, do I feel like I have to work twice as hard because I'm Black? Well, maybe not because I'm Black, but I do feel like being exact and being thorough, it is a part of being an engineer, first and foremost. But yes, do I feel like there is a certain level of scrutiny, or have I felt like that in the past? Absolutely. Because of that. Now, can I prove it?
I don't know. I am very open about my journey, man. I've worked in some toxic environments. I've almost always been the only Black man. And some of my organizations, you know, it was a team of 47 people. I'm the only Black man. I think there were three other Black women, maybe two individuals who may have identified as Asian American. So a large part of my career, you know, has not been in the most diverse environments. And I've always felt that, right? Like, whereas, you know, some people can be late. I felt a lot of pressure to always be early and on time, right? I felt like I can't say no when I'm asked to do things, because as the only Black man, I not only represent me, I represent people who will come behind me, right? And if I don't do good, will they hire someone else who looks like me, right? And so I've always felt like this intense amount of pressure. And as I've gotten older and I've grown professionally and I've listened to people talk, and I realized that, you know, I just gotta be me. I can't do it. I can't, like, I'm always put on for the culture, right? But I can't kill myself worrying about if I'm good enough, but that's hard, man. And so I was wondering, like, you know, like, you're I work in politics, you know, you work in engineering, and I think engineering is like very scientific. You know, you talked about being very exact, you know, the numbers have to match, the computations have to match. I just wonder, like, you know, like, on a very visceral level, have you felt that?
to your point of sometimes feeling like I have to take on more tasks than I should just because I'm asked, absolutely. I never want to leave anything to chance, especially when it comes to being promoted, given a raise, and those things. And sometimes I think in being either the only Black or one of two, which I think is the most for me, sometimes it's been harder to develop relationships with our leadership and our managers, just because naturally I don't communicate the way that, you know, a lot of my peers do. And I think that ultimately is a barrier, but you're exactly right in that, you know, we have to be ourselves, you know, knowing that we're not for everybody, but that we still do our best job is enough for me.
That's good. I think that's a good point, Brock. I want to make sure people hear that, because we have a lot of people who want to be engineers or who are the only ones. And that's just a salient point, that you have to know that being yourself is enough for you. And so, you know, we're going to talk about that, but I want to get a story, because, you know, stories are important, right? And we talk a lot of time about microaggressions, and some people believe microaggressions are real. Some people don't believe microaggressions. Look, I've experienced them. I've lived them. I know they're real. But they may not be immediately apparent always to everyone. Some researchers call it death by a thousand cuts. And can you share one of maybe the most memorable or painful paper cuts you've experienced, or microaggressions you've experienced in your career?
Well, I will say that working through the years that the Obama administration was in office, President Obama's administration was in office.
Put some respect on President Obama's name. Stop playing, my man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think those were tough years for anybody Black in corporate America. Just because anytime, you know, President Obama was doing anything, it was heavily scrutinized. And you would often hear, you know, people saying little things at work, or sometimes not talking when you come around after you know that they were clearly having a conversation about something. To give you a story, I had a manager when I was living in Philadelphia who used to always say things like, I don't understand why, you know, people feel like they're owed something. Like, it was constant. And I was direct with him at one point, because I just, you know, he would say that in different ways, you know, every now and then. But there was this one day where I was just like, you know, you wonder why people feel like they're owed something. And there were two white guys in the room. And I asked, one white guy said, what is your background and where does your family come from? And he went into this long spiel about, you know, where his forefathers were from, and went on to talk about this shield, this family crest. And I asked the manager him the same question, and he went into his talk, and he went into his lineage. And so I asked them, I said, now ask me that question. And they said, yeah, where's your family from? I said, well, my mom's family is from North Carolina, and my dad's family is from Georgia. After that, I can't really find anything, because my heritage was robbed from me. And I said, do you see how excited you got when you talked about your lineage? Imagine not being able to do that when somebody asks you of that. There's a disconnect between the races in this country. And it's sort of amazing how, you know, us as Black people in corporate America have to live and know about what, you know, what's happening in popular culture, and kind of also know what's going on in ours, if that is your if that's what you relate to. But they don't have to know anything about ours. And, you know, that's just one story. But there, you know, a lot of microaggressions all the time, whether they're direct or, you know, indirect.
Mm-hmm. What you said is interesting, because it really made me think about there's this poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar, We Wear the Mask. And, you know, the first two lines of the first stanza, you know, reads, we wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. And it makes me think about like where we are when we're at work. I think a lot of times organizations and companies, you know, they say, come as you are, bring your whole self to work. And I don't think that Black people ever really have that luxury of bringing our whole selves to work, right? Because we still work in these white dominant cultures where some of the things that we deem may be, you know, acceptable, they could deem not acceptable. You know, I think about a lot of my friends, I have a lot of female friends who are leaders and they work in corporate America, you know, and they still have questions about how they wear their hair. Right. Like, oh, they may come in with it straight one day and then kinky twist the next day. And then the next week, micro braids, and people still feel empowered to do things like that. So I think that that story about microaggressions, you know, I searched because I never want to leave people out when we ask these questions. And I thought about some of the many microaggressions I felt. And I think the one that really, man, jumps out to me is, you know, I think anyone who knows me knows that I'm a pretty jovial person. You know what I'm saying? I almost always have a smile on my face so I can find something to laugh about. And I managed an entire team of, it's interesting, white women. And, you know, I would send culture surveys around and ask, like, how are we doing, you know, culturally? Do you all feel supported? Do you have what you need to be successful? You know, I had office hours, all of these different things, numerous ways, right, to gauge and get feedback. And somebody on my team went to the leader of the organization and told them that they were intimidated by me. Never once did I hear that from them, you know, and it made me think about something that I saw on social media one day. And it was like, I'm not intimidating. You are intimidated. Right. And like, you know, I think that a lot of times, man, you know, when I worked in D.C., I was on Capitol Hill. And I met this young lady, white lady. She was from like Iowa. And she told me before she moved to DC, she had never seen a Black person before. And I was like, I drove through Iowa. I kept it going. No disrespect to Iowa. Shout out to Iowa. The Hawkeyes, Iowa Hawkeyes are in the Big Ten. Big Ten is the best football conference in football. I want to shout that out. But I never spent time in Iowa. And hold on, let's not hate on Big Ten. But what I will say is, like, you know, I think there are a lot of people in that boat who just don't get what it means. We talked about this, and you know, that lady said that she was the only person, when she moved to D.C., that was the first time she saw a Black person. I want to talk to you, like, have you ever, and ask you, like, have you ever been the only person of color or like, Black man in your office? And if so, how did you handle that? What was it like?
I don't know about the only Black male in my office. I've definitely been the only Black male on a team. Oh yeah, on a project. And you know, for a large portion of my career, I really kept my personal life personal, and you know, went to work, put my head down, put my headphones on and got my work done and went home. So I didn't really allow myself the opportunity to, you know, really engage enough to actually care about it. And I think that may be unique to a lot of STEM careers, which a lot, like, especially like your coders or people who work with computer software. Anytime you're doing any type of design work, similar to art, almost, if you will, you're given a task and you're just expected to, you know, deliver whatever the expected outcome is. And as long as you deliver that on time and you use, you know, you're a lot of resources, you're good. A lot of people won't, you know, give you a lot of flack. I think for people who have the aspiration to move the corporate ladder, it's a little bit different when you're the only Black person, because you then have to force yourself to, you know, some people say play the game, but it's really build relationships and build meaningful relationships with people. And I think anytime you do that in a corporate setting, even race removed, there's going to be backstabbing and, you know, people talking behind each other's back. But I think when you add in that factor of race, sometimes we as Black folks may become hyper aware and hypersensitive to a lot of things that may not be there. There was this one instance. I was the only Black male at, I won't say the name, well, I've already said it, at Gulfstream as a co-op. And somebody said something, like all the co-ops had this, you know, group email. And somebody said some term that I took differently from their intent. And I thought they were making a racial statement. And I, you know, spoke up as I, you know, have been taught to do since I was a child. And I was in the wrong because of the, I guess, the communication barrier between our cultures.
Do you, would you feel comfortable sharing what the term was? What was the term?
I forget what the term was. I really do. But it may have been just the way they, it felt racist. And I might have, you know, I might have been right. But a lot is lost through email and text.
But if it felt racist, odds are it was racist.
But somebody explained to me what she was saying. I was like, oh, you know, my bad. And then I, you know, just kept it moving from there, became less engaged, which sometimes can be a byproduct of being the only Black person if you're not received well. You know, sometimes, Rob, I think it's about, you know, figuring out where you fit. You know, a lot recently I've seen, you know, different things on social media, LinkedIn, talking about the value of, you know, for instance, a car in different scenarios and how it has different value in different scenarios. Ultimately, you have to determine what the best fit is for you and, you know, where you feel like you're valued the most and add value to whatever organization or you know, business that you decide to work with.
Now, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Like, let me ask you this. Did you feel like you didn't want to be that guy? And that's why, like, you kind of, oh, let me pull back off that. I don't want to be the guy that, yeah, nah, that's.
Absolutely. I mean, but you have to consider at such a young age, 20, you know, 19, 20 as a co-op, we still all want to be liked. I, you know, regardless, no, I don't think anybody pursues rejection from their peers. And if they do, you know, self-sabotage is not adversity. So I wanted to, you know, make sure that, you know, it was still a cohesive group and, you know, everybody got along. I feel like I'm less like that now, but I still engage in a way that I'm able to build valuable relationships without compromising my integrity. Yeah,
that's something that's so interesting. And it makes me think about like Issa Rae. You know, I was reading up and Issa Rae recently stated that she feared being seen as like difficult to work with. She was on Meghan Markle's podcast, Archetypes. And, you know, she shared that the best advice she ever received was, don't ever be afraid to be a bitch. And for some context, you know, she said she had reached out to several people in the entertainment industry. And she had some fear stemming from like seeing how female creatives were being treated in Hollywood. And Issa said whenever she reached out to women writers or women directors, she'd hear feedback from men and in some cases other women about like why she should not work with them. And I wanted to know, like, have you ever experienced like this fear, right, of being seen as difficult to work with? You talked about a little bit just a while ago. Or do you think you ever changed your behavior? You know what I mean? Because you're a Black man and that fear. And I think about myself, like earlier in my career, like I was quick to protect white women, right? Yeah, because it was always me. And, you know, the Emmett Till movie just came out, right? And like, I'm a Black man in America. I've been socialized as a Black man in America, right? And it wasn't until I grew up a little bit, man, in my career. And I never forget having a conversation with one of my managers. And I love her to this day. I still talk to her. She's probably one of the best managers I've ever had. She's a white woman, though. And we were having a difficult conversation. And she started crying. And I had to tell her, stop crying. Right. Like, because when you cry even if I have the moral high ground, right? Like if what I am saying is correct, is right. When a white woman starts crying as a result of a conversation with a Black man, it very rarely ends well for whoever that person of color.
Absolutely. You made me think about something that happened when I was living in Atlanta. I was working for this airline subsidiary. And there was one other Black designer. I was working in certification where we kind of test different flight instruments and get those certified so that they can actually fly. But this other the other Black guy was a designer, and we used to have weekly team meetings. And in one of the team meetings, there was this white guy who decided it was the appropriate time to talk about how bad of a job the Black guy was doing, as far with everyone else. And I guess he was reviewing his drawings or whatever. But he started going off about it, and everybody else was quiet. And I said, wait, you know, are we trying to help each other or hurt each other? If you are recognizing a pattern of, you know, maybe some inconsistencies or maybe some things that he didn't do to your standard or whatever, you should take that up with him. You instead of trying to sabotage this man in front of everybody. And come to think of it, you know, I probably set myself up being the only other Black person to, you know, be looked at in a way now where like, oh, you're going to defend him in front of all these people. Being the only other Black male, you know, they probably looked at me in a certain way like, well, if we can find a way to get him out, you know, we will. But, you know, that came from that maturity that we were speaking about earlier and you know, not being afraid to, as Issa put it, you know, be a bee. And I think I am just at a point in my life and a point in my career now where I can say, you know, this job ain't the end all be all. Like, you know, if I have to walk away from this for whatever reason, knowing that I did the right thing, then okay, I'm fine with that. But, you know,
I can get another job. We can get another job.
Yeah, we can get another job. But to watch somebody else be, you know, disrespected in a way that I just thought was very rude and very unprofessional, and watch everybody else just sitting around looking, I'm going to speak up for the Black people. And if they are really wrong, then, you know, we'll talk about that later in private. But I can't just watch my dog get, you know, get dogged out, get taken out the pasture. I can't sit and watch that.
So I think that's hard, man, because, you know, I've worked at places where, you know, we're in big meetings with donors and with other groups and with other people, and blatantly racist things are said. And and like not I'm not talking about like covert. I'm talking about like microaggressions that are really in your face, dog whistles. And there's a burden that comes with being Black or person of color in organizations, because if you don't speak up, odds are other someone else may not speak up, right? Like, and so like
9 times out of 9, they probably won't.
Yeah, you know, and they may feel like, oh, you know, the person of color didn't say anything. And I've also worked at places where younger staff have been in the conversation and they've not been empowered, right? Like to speak up. But it was amazing that you was able to be an ally to that gentleman.
But Rob, what does that say about what we value, you know, in the workplace? I don't think, you know, ultimately the value is put on doing what's right. You know, I don't think the value is being put on, you know, doing things that are just or doing the right thing. I think it's, let me see what I can do as an individual to get the most out of this company for myself, even if that means staying quiet. I mean, you see it, you know, all across the entertainment industry with, you know, people being canceled and, you know, certain people not saying anything, you know, just because, hey, I don't want to affect my dollar. I mean, that is the trade-off to capitalism.
Ooh, are we going there, bro? Are we about to have this conversation? Because I'm available. But, you know, I've been deep in it the past week and a half, really, really deep in it the past week and a half about what happened with Kanye, to be very honest, like, right? Like, I've been deep in it. And, you know, full stop, you know, I do not support, you know, anti-Semitic messages being shared. Full stop. I had the privilege of spending an extended amount of time in Israel, traveling Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Jaffa, you know, Capernaum, all up and down the country of Israel. And one thing that struck me really, really hard, like I was hurt. I was down bad about this. It even impacted the way I interacted with my wife last Wednesday night, because I was just reflecting upon the fact that, you know, Kanye said these things, asinine statements. People, you know, berated him for it. Adidas left Kanye. You know, they said we're you know, terminating our relationship. All these Balenciaga, all these Gap, all these different brands. Maybe not Gap. I think he had canceled Gap before, but all these different brands, they got out of there because Kanye made these statements about, you know, Jewish people. But I was hurt. And it's not about the statements about Kanye. Kanye made, it was about how, in my opinion, the response by these companies was clearly anti-Black. And I say that because when Kanye said the statement about George Floyd not dying at the knee of that police officer who we're not going to say his name in Minneapolis, right? When Kanye said that slavery was a choice, none of these companies left Kanye. And so that had me reflecting upon who is entitled to protection and who is not entitled to protection. And why is it that Kanye can say these statements about Jewish people and immediately within days lose $2 billion, right? Lose partnerships, lose all these different, you know, ambassadorships, brand ambassadorships, all these different connections. But Kanye can say blatantly like anti-Black things and not one single company used that. And more so I looked at the statement that Adidas put out. Adidas put out this statement saying, you know, we're terminating our connection with Kanye West because of this statement that he made and et cetera, et cetera. And what they preferenced was the anti-Semitic statements that he made, but they said nothing about the anti-Black statements, like literally nothing. And it really, really had me thinking like how unvalued I felt, right? Like how unprotected. And I think that like society selective outrage about like and when we choose to use it, right? And like actually like who we use it in service of, thinking about like who's worthy of justice and who's not. That really had me thinking about that. And I think that like it would have been so much better to me if Adidas, right, would have said in that statement as well, you know what, if they would have been able to put on the same line
the anti-black statements that he made.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? To put those on the same thing and use public pressure to show that both Jewish people and black people are deserving of protection. You can't make hate, because hate speech is hate speech.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, they, and you have to talk about these entities as individual entities. Nobody has proven any type of collusion among any race or religion, however you classify Jews. But if they let him get away with saying these anti-black things and continue to say, well, you know, our product is still worth pushing with him, you know, being the face or whatever, because we know that there will not be any repercussions. There is, like you said, nobody protecting, you know, our feelings, our being. There is no military that will come to the rescue of Black Americans. There is no cancel. Black people don't permanently cancel anybody.
I had that conversation too. Like Black people don't cancel. But one person said this to me in my DMs on Instagram. They said, you know, Black people are born canceled. So the notion of subjecting further harm onto another Black person is far away. It seems outside of our reach. And, you know, I just think about this concept of who has power, who does not have power, who has the ability to cancel individuals, who does not have the ability to cancel, and what people are canceled for is something that I find so fascinating. And like I said, I want to be clear. The part that hit me like a bag of bricks was the anti-black part, right? The anti-black positions that Kanye West took, and how there was just no mention of that in any of the, that I've seen. Now, I could be wrong. I haven't seen everything, but there was no mention of any of it in terms of reasons why people chose to part ways with Kanye West, when, in my opinion, you know, and a rabbi, I think a rabbi, she put it the best. And, you know, she tweeted out, she said, while I see the logic of putting the anti-Semitism, which is the most recent thing, at the top of the piece, the anti-black choices lower down, less recent, a justice perspective, right? Because that's what we're always should be seeking, right? Justice. She said a justice perspective would have found a way to list both prominently, because that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about creating a justice, and who has access to justice in this country and in this world and in this society, and who doesn't. And so that's something that just stuck with me. I'm glad that you took us there, because I think that is worth discussing for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that is that leads, you know, as far as Black people in this country are concerned, us to determining what our values are and what values we're going to protect. If we can even get there, are we too disconnected from our past? You know, because one thing that you hear a lot when anytime the word anti-Semitism is brought up is that, you know, you should visit this Holocaust museum just to show you, you know, what is happened to our people, and maybe that you may have a different perspective and realize what you said may have been an error, because they know their history, and to know your history is to avoid repeating history, really. And I think, you know, within our Black homes, you know, as my parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles did, you know, for me, my siblings, family members and friends, was, you know, reinforce our history, where we came from. And we have to do a better job of that in order to, you know, keep that in our mind. Like, hey, we're not going back here. You know, we're constantly going forward. up and onward.
Yeah, no, that is real. I think that when I was in Israel, one thing that I was struck by is this phrase that they use, you know, Jewish people in Israel, I think Jewish people all over the world use, and it's two words, you know, never again, right? Never again. And it's a solemn pledge to like never forget the horrors and atrocities that happened during the Holocaust, so that, like you said, it won't be repeated. And it makes me think, is there a phrase? Is there a caption that Black people should come up with so that we can push people to understand what like slavery, right? Like you know, what is a never again for Black people so that, you know, we do not forget our roots? Because when we think about, you know, slavery, you know, slavery really just, you know, metamorphosized into the penal system. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you think about the 13th Amendment, slavery just metamorphosized into the penal system. And so like a lot of Black people, we're like, what, 13-16% of the population, but we make up the overwhelming majority of jails. Come on, man. It just doesn't make sense. Math is mathing.
I don't know that we necessarily have to come up with a unique phrase, but just as you said that, you know, going to Israel was impactful for you, I went to Ghana for my 30th birthday, and I was able to go to Cape Coast Castle, which is really a dungeon, you know, from the Slave River. They come to this dungeon to see the door of no return. They're held in this dungeon until, you know, they're off to the Americas or wherever, you know, they're being shipped. But I don't think we necessarily need a unique term, but just to understand that, you know, one, we need to remember what happened to us. And even for those who came before Columbus, because, you know, Blacks arrived on this continent in South America before the Europeans did. So, you know, we can't just limit it, you know, just to that slave trade, because, you know, we were enslaved, you know, people were enslaved who were already here, who are the same color as you and me. But we have to have a collective value of what our history is so that we don't repeat it. I also think we have to have a collective value of of pooling resources, trusting one another. I think that's big in a lot of other communities, which I think now is growing. You made me think about something earlier that I wanted to touch on, and I hate that I'm veering, but earlier you mentioned about how sometimes Black females in the workplace, for the longest, had trouble with wearing certain hairstyles. And I think more recently, there are a lot of, you know, departments within organizations that promote diversity and inclusiveness and, you know, really push being your whole self and bringing your whole self to work. But one thing that I have observed is that what really led that was the emergence and the pooling of resources behind the LGBTQ plus movement. And, you know, I'm all for be your full self, but it just like how you said, it hits you with a ton of bricks with the whole Adidas not recognizing the anti-Black comments. It kind of does the same for me, where you have Black women and Black people in general, Black men who couldn't wear dreads or, you know, had long beards, have had to subscribe to this caricature or, you know, costume of what a professional work environment was. But then you have this movement that quickly sweeps, you know, this movement into where, you know, we have to accept all people, and we're kind of shuffled in with that. I maybe the two aren't related, but I from what I have observed, they're very similar.
I want to understand more what you're saying about the two. I want to be clear. I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that the influence that individuals in the LGBTQ community has amassed has allowed Black people to be more accepted? I want to make sure, because I'm not sure what you were saying.
In a way, yes. And I say that because if we are going to allow any type of dress or, you know, how you present yourself at work to be outside, you know, what has been for years pretty across the board for what, you know, professionalism looks like. If we're going to say we're going to allow that to change, even, you know, even with companies relaxing, you know, what business casual means, you know, allowing people to wear jeans or not being so restrictive on, you know, anything that you might wear. I think that what the LGBTQ plus community has really done for the better of all people is allow people to be accepted as who they are at work. And that includes people wearing their different hairstyles, beards, dressing however they want to dress, and what have you. I'm not, I just don't want you to misconstrue my thought.
Sure.
If that's what
no,
you were.
No, I think yeah. I understand what you're saying now. This brings me to one of my our last questions, and I think that this is a time for you to really impart wisdom, right? And so, you know, when you think about this, this podcast is for Black people who are one of the few or the only ones navigating that, you know, tumultuous journey. You wake up, go to work, see no one who looks like you, no one who understands, you know, what it means when you hear "in my mind." You know, we automatically think it's Temptations, right? We like who may not have grown up and heard, you know, your mother or your parent, guardian say to you, you know, close that door or go wash. You smell like outside. Like there are connections, right? No matter where you are, that being Black creates for you ways that you can plug in, right? And so I want to know for you, like, what parting words would you leave with Black people who are going to listen to this podcast, who are going to come behind you in the engineering field? What words of advice do you have for them, you know, pursuing engineering positions? And just for Black people who wake up every day and go to work and are surrounded by people who do not look like them, because you've been there before. And not only have you been there, you've been able to succeed and excel at an amazing rate. What would you say to those people who are going to listen to this, who are going to see this, who are going to come behind you? What parting words of wisdom do you want to leave them?
I would just say to do your best, make good decisions, be honest with yourself, whether that be, you know, like we talked about earlier, is this organization and is the role that I'm in fulfilling? And am I valued? I would be honest, you know, with myself so that you can give your best every day. I would also encourage folks who are engineers or any other industry to look at challenges as opportunities and to always be confident in yourself. And you know, sometimes being confident means double checking your work. Sometimes the confident person is the one who knows I have to be thorough in everything that I do. But yeah, I would just leave it at that. My dad used to say that to me every time I left the house. Make good decisions and do your best. So that's where I'm at with it.
Well, your dad was a wise man. Your dad was a wise man. I routinely, anybody who follows me on social media, I say to my kids, make good decisions, right? Like, I teach them how to make good decisions. Conversely, though, Brock, I want to ask you one additional question, because we talked about, you said it, you know, and I said it. Oftentimes, individuals who do not look like us are in these rooms where things are being said. And, you know, sometimes they step up. Sometimes they don't. You know, you never know. But if you could broadcast a message to white allies who want to step up, who want to do the right thing, who are in those rooms, right, when the managers berating that black man and talking about his performance, right, what would you tell them? What message would you leave for the white man, white woman, white person who identifies as they, however they identify? What message would you tell them?
Just to speak up when you know something needs to be brought to everyone's attention. I mean, as humans, we all have this gut feeling when we know something is wrong. And a lot of times we let our strategy or, you know, position get in the way of doing what's right. Now, that may be a lofty goal, but that's what's really in my heart. Speak up when you know something is wrong. You know, don't be a coward about things.
I think that is absolutely correct. The most important thing that people can do is speak up. And speaking up is hard, right? I want to be very honest. And it's hard, but it's the right thing to do. And if we do the right thing, if we make...
Once you speak up and just simply say whatever it is, you can no longer... whoever's in charge can no longer ignore it without there being some sort of consequence. But, if you bring something up and it's on the record, you know, it can only backfire on someone who's trying to keep somebody else at a disadvantage.
That's very true. That's very true. Well, Michael Brock, proud HBCU alum, engineer, husband, father, I want to thank you for gracing us and making your presence felt and known here at the Black Work Experience Podcast. It's an honor. It's a truly, truly honor to have you on here. And I know the people who listen to this podcast, who want to become engineers, who are going to go to work tomorrow, the day after that, and see no one who looks like them, have been blessed by like your perspective on things. I know I was. So thank you for joining us, Brock.
Thank you for having me, man. The pleasure was all mine.
All right. Have a good one. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Black Work Experience Podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us. If you would like to hear more, follow us on IG at BWEP. We're also on Twitter at BWE Podcast. Black Work Experience is hosted and produced by me, Robert Stevens. Our show is mixed by Strategic Communications Specialist Sarah Daggett. Find out more about her amazing work at DaggettConsultingLLC.com. That's Daggett, DAGGETT, ConsultingLLC.com. Our theme music was composed by Cameron Wright. If you would like to contribute to Mail Time, please submit your mail times on our IG at BWE Pod. You can also DM us on Twitter at BWE Podcast or via email at BlackWorkExperiencePod@gmail.com.